This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 14th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 310 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's show, we'll be meeting a US political heavyweight, the governor of Virginia, Terry McAuliffe, to find out why his home state is taking to two wheels.
And we'll be hearing from Alabama Shakes, the Grammy-nominated soul rockers, whose latest intelligently pitched pop offering is seeing them not only win over the big stages, but critics and new fans alike.
And we'll speak with Richard Dobbs, director of the McKinsey Global Institute, to hear about oncoming disruptions to the world economy that market-savvy global thinkers should all be taking notes on.
That's all coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly. Plus, of course, let's not forget Tom Edwards and his news look ahead. That's all coming up on the show. Woof, here we are.
Well, this week you want to take a chainsaw to every bloody tree, don't you?
I know. I'm a fan of the forest. I'm a country boy at heart. For the first time in 37 years, I've woken up with the most weird and horrible hay fever. I've never had it before. I'm streaming from. I don't want to use the phrase every orifice, so I won't. But my eyes and nose.
Yeah, I look a bit red of face. And I must say that my only hope is here in the studio with the filters going, maybe some relief. It's good to be on the radio, Rob. It's good for your health.
It's great to be here in Studio One. I love the air conditioning. Hooray, this is the future. This is good, isn't it?
Especially when it's nice and sunny outside.
It's nice. Actually, this week, because the sun has had its hat on, at least for the last part of the week here in London, it's actually been quite nice. We've had some quality Studio One and Studio Two time, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. And
either together or apart.
It's been a nice kind of a very rare moment that it's actually between projects. There was nothing actually going out the door this week. So that was all good. Should we get him in? Should we get him, Mr. Tom Edwards?
Eduardo.
Who's got a waggy tail?
Who's got a winning grin?
Who can sniff out the spookiest news?
Who knows when to bark and bite?
Who's got the nicest coat?
Who can round up some global tales?
Who can scent a breaking story?
And who likes his tummy tickled?
Oh yes, it's that lovable news hound.
It's Tom Edwards.
Come home, Daddy.
Oh, little bark, just to sign off there.
Hi, Tom.
Greetings, one and all.
And nice to see you.
I've come out of my news kennel to join you.
Ah, what have you got in there? What bone have you been chewing?
Yeah, a few old bits and bobs in there.
Yeah.
It's pretty nondescript, to be honest.
Is it?
Yeah.
Do you go over the wet food or the dry food?
Dry.
Really?
But make sure you leave, at least 2 fingers of water for your dog to be drinking.
2 fingers of water?
You mean as an amount?
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Oh, not, yeah. I mean, that's for the human owner to take care of.
Okay, good.
Some dog with hands. That'd be horrible.
That'd be really strange, isn't it?
Anyway, off we go on the news.
Could
sledge.
Be a pointer.
Yeah. Hey!
Zinger.
Andrew's going to be making his thinking of a joke face for the entirety of this section of the programme now. I can say it's like this.
That's what that face is.
He's looking at me. It's true.
I thought that was
thinking of people to fire.
Maybe it's similar. We don't know. Shall we start with some politics sort of news and developments? A couple of things on either side of the pond for tomorrow. Jeb Bush, the Florida governor, is formally announcing his campaign for the Republican nomination tomorrow. And also, I think this is interesting for a variety of reasons. You can do the compare and contrast, not just with his sibling, but with his dad. And there's already, various controversies from his past. If it does become a sort of Bush-Clinton face-off, it'll be really interesting because it's almost like their past is more relevant than the future for both those candidates. And I just think that'll be interesting. Meanwhile, here in the UK, the Labour Party, so the defeated opposition or re-defeated opposition, are closing the nominations for their leaderships. And again, it's a completely different kind of race. It has different implications, worldwide. It's probably not something that's going to compel everybody, but it's interesting in its own way. Will there be more of a shift to the left, a shift back to the I don't know, the centre left or almost to completely the central ground. And interesting for the, I guess, you know, the political machinations of both countries for, you know, the next, what, 5-10 years potentially.
Very interesting. Very nicely summed up, Tom. Thank you.
You should be in news.
Well, I try. I turn into a weird man, human dog hybrid.
Human dog hybrid.
Should we take to the skies?
Yes,
tomorrow?
Please.
Yes.
Paris Air Show, which obviously that and Farnborough, they take it a year each. This is a real big one. It's Salon International de l'Aéronautique et de l'Espace.
Well done there.
On Paris. And it obviously,
does that come with vegetables or?
You can get that with
yourself. Or frites.
Yeah.
Frites.
Les verts. But Monocle's transport editor is there. He'll be doing actually a show, a live show sort of coming partly from Paris, partly from London, tomorrow and Tuesday. So we'll be there amongst all of the stalls with the high
stalls.
Stalls. I don't know. It's kind of grander than that if you've been to any of these.
Boeing brings a little kind of table, throws a tablecloth over it.
But it not even stands. I don't know. It's like sections. That's really.
I have no kind of conception of what these things look like. I quite like to go to one of these.
It's actually amazing. I went to, with Tristan, to Farnborough last summer.
Yeah.
And it was a revelation to me. And they properly put on a show. Like, they get these huge jets and do crazy stuff.
Yeah, because they get like normal passenger planes and get them to do loops, and
like
really
empty
weird
ones with,
yeah,
basically someone who's escaped from some kind of lunatic institution and driving it, and they'll take it off, and it will have taken off for about 5 seconds, and they'll just bank it to the right, to the left, fly it at seemingly no speed whatsoever, and you can do these things to them.
Yeah,
absolutely amazing.
That's kind of heartening when you're on a sort of long haul flight.
It made me feel
like
a great director, because I can still get a little, you know,
you get a little jittery,
edgy about
you,
flying.
You have two fingers of something before you get on the plane,
and the rest,
and a drink,
and a proper drink.
What I like about those shows always, as well, is that there is always like comedy sound effects in the background when everyone's broadcasting. It's like,
that is true. That was good.
Quite good.
Mine
sounded like a squirrel falling out of a tree.
Very big this year, apparently. Rodent aviation is one of the big things. I've got one for you, Andrew, for tomorrow. Do you know what's also tomorrow? It's World Meat Free Day.
Okay, good. I wonder what he was going to pick then.
No meetings all of Monday.
Perfect. Yeah, no meetings. No, this is genuinely true. World Meat Free Day. It's not just about principled, whether it's vegetarianism because of health, or this is about, you know, also about meat sustainability. So it's even inviting regular meat eaters just for a day to sort of.
But do people eat meat every day? I don't. I'm sure there are three days a week or 4 days a week when I don't eat any meat.
Oh really?
Yeah.
I think there's.
I love it,
quite
but
few,
I think you have to be sparing with it. You have to be quite sparing with it, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
Yeah. That's good. I'll sign up for that. I like that.
But that's important. And then it's Art Basel next week.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually going to be away in Thailand, but we have our friend Austin Ward. He's going to be phoning in, isn't he, on our live programmes.
Yeah. Checking with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's
I thought it was a bit warmer. So, more fool them if having it in Switzerland.
You preferred the version in Miami, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm booked in for that.
I can't miss that one. That's really important.
Okay, let's... come on.
That's a bit unfair. And then, do you know who else is getting exciting next week? Not just the great and good of the art world. Druids.
Ah, love
it's,
this.
It's solstice stuff. Time.
Stonehenge. Are they allowed to go to Stonehenge?
They still are.
Okay. Yeah.
It's just for 3 days. So, from I think it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday of this coming week. You can get right up amongst the ancient stones. I don't know if you have to be a druid. I think only the actual druids are allowed to get amongst it.
But I wonder how that works. I mean, how do you sort of, you presumably have to be vetted?
I don't know if they have a very rigorous system of identity cards, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
I'm not sure.
One white cloak looks very much like another, I expect, from a distance anyway, to me. Mm. But I'm quite interested in all that.
I think it's a shame that you can't get up, because apparently you used to be able to, you could sort of literally camp out there. Sleep amongst the sun would rise. It must have been incredible. Now it's a bit, you know, carefully managed.
It's very.
I think some
managed.
Of that old romance has gone a bit.
Yeah.
But the druids all, they bring it back once a year.
I like quite like Stonehenge. Do you ever drive down that part of the countryside?
Well, I do
and
actually.
And when you're in the car and you suddenly see it on the hill,
it's incredible. Yeah, I think it's amazing.
I've chipped a few bits off over the years, got back of the house.
No.
I'm not sure you're allowed to do that.
No.
National Heritage will be calling.
He's got it as a paperweight. Well, you've got one bit, and you stop the bathroom door opening. It's good, isn't it? Did Andrew, you've stopped making your joke face?
Well, I wasn't thinking about a joke. I wasn't.
I can't think of a single sort of anthropomorphic dog as human joke. I can't think of one.
Yeah, we're not going to do that. We'll do that another time. Is that all? I'm turning over pages here. Abandon.
That's next week's news today.
Thank you, Tom. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be meeting the Governor of Virginia, Terry McAuliffe. Don't go away.
From Istanbul.
From Hong Kong.
This is Monocle 24.
Tokyosta. Tämä on Monocle 24.
こちらは Monocle 24です。
Questa è Monocle 24.
To Paris. To Munich.
From London.
To Berlin.
To Istanbul.
To Frankfurt.
To Zurich.
To Madrid.
To Singapore.
To Barcelona.
To Toronto.
To Helsinki.
To New York.
To Lisbon.
To Tokyo.
Broadcasting around the world, around the clock.
Monaco, Fairance, Wanzers.
From Midori House in London, you're tuned to Monaco 24.
The news is never short of stories coming from the staunchly adversarial arena of US politics, and we have one of its major players as our first guest on the Monocle Weekly. But today, Terry McAuliffe, Governor of Virginia, confidant of the Clintons, is in the UK not just to talk about the political makeup of his home country, he's here to discuss a newfound sporting love in his home state too. Cycling.
In September this year, Richmond in Virginia will host the UCI Road World Championships. And a love of two-wheeled talent is something that both Terry's local constituents and the sports fans in Europe at races such as the Tour de France and the Giro d'Italia share. And Terry joins us on the line now for a little bit more. Terry, thanks very much for joining us. And obviously, we can't speak to you in studio today because you're cycling around all the countries in Europe that you've been visiting. I'm only just joking there, aren't I? You're obviously here to promote the World Cycling World Road Championships coming to Virginia. This is such a Eurocentric thing. How are you gonna stage it in Virginia, and how's it going to be different?
Well, it's exciting. So we're hosting this UCI World Bike Championship. It'll be 9 days in Richmond, Virginia. 450,000 spectators will be coming to Virginia, most of them around the Richmond area. 300 million folks will watch this bike race on television. So I can tell you, as governor, I'm pretty fired up because for 9 days, 300 million people will be seeing Richmond, Virginia, seeing all our historic sites. And, you know, we were, you know, obviously central to the Civil War and all the monuments and all the issues that go with that. So it's a tremendous opportunity for us to highlight Virginia, to highlight Richmond, Virginia, and to get, as I say, 450,000 folks. Many of them, I assume, will be coming to Virginia for the first time. So it's an exciting time for all of us. We're getting ready. The bike routes have all been already designed, ready to go. If you come to Richmond right now, there's a paving truck on about every single road that we have.
And presumably, I mean, this is a good advert for cycling in the United States. I mean, clearly there have been some amazing races to come out of your country, but it's a good opportunity, presumably, to say that America likes bikes, not just cars as well, right?
Well, right. There's a lot of messages that come out that we're trying to do around this. Obviously, to get more people on bikes, to get them out of cars. Obviously, we're all trying to do the best we can to, you know, build a sustainable earth. And getting more people to ride to work or to bike around is important. So I think this will be a huge side effect that will come off of that. I think people watching this will get excited. I was out the other day going to a couple events. I happened to walk by a bike shop. So I just poked my head in, asked, introduced myself, and asked the owner how things were going. He said the excitement and enthusiasm just around the bike race, he has seen his business double. So I just think there's so many benefits that will come off of this, and to have all these athletes from, you know, as you know, this is country versus country. This is good, healthy competition. And I think as we move forward, I think that we'll have a real impact on Virginia, on our health and the way we go about commuting.
And tell us, how does it come to Virginia? Is that down to yourself? Is that down to the state? How did it end up with you?
Well, it's a huge bidding process, as you know, and you have to show financial sustainability. And this is something I give tremendous credit to the mayor of Richmond, Dwight Jones. The city decided. They went after it. They put the key is you have to put all your sponsors together to prove that you can financially handle this. And we've raised millions and millions of dollars. We're still raising money. We're almost at the end. But as I say, and the fact that the folks were in to see me the other day to ask me to make a couple more calls, which I was glad to do, because the idea as governor that I'm going to have 300 million people looking at the state that I run, it gives me a tremendous opportunity to leverage that to bring more businesses in. After we're done, in 2 years it goes to Qatar when we finish up. So in 2 years it'll be going over to the Middle East. But it's very intense competition for it, as it should be. Every hotel in the entire area is totally sold out and has been sold out for a long, long time.
Now, Terry, one of your colleagues in the Democrats made kind of cycling news the other day in not such a good way, heading for Switzerland downhill rather fast. Yeah. Were you a bit worried for him?
Yeah. I mean, listen, John is a great athlete. John would, in fairness, have it no other way. He's aggressively skier, windsurfer, biker, and he goes out with his security team. I mean, obviously, he's in intense negotiations on behalf of the United States of America. He was over there meeting with the Iranians, trying to get that deal to some type of closure. And, you know, to just go outside and get your bike helmet on and jump on that bike, for a lot of people, myself included, it's a way to just escape and to get out there. And it's you and your bike out there with nature. So I was worried because, you know, whenever you fall, as he hit a curb and went flying, it could affect you. But I will tell you this, it wasn't only bikes. I was in Africa over Christmas, and I was out with my family. I was on a big stallion. He got spooked. He threw me. I broke 7 ribs, punctured my lung. You know,
wow.
I wouldn't have it any other way either. You got to be honest.
I feel like I'm on the frontier here, not in Richmond, Virginia, Terry.
Yeah.
And is cycling a big deal in the state? Is it a growing thing, or is it sort of grassroots? I mean, I know you guys make wine. It's not just that you share in common with the Tour de France, is it?
We do a lot more than make wine, let me tell you that. But we're great at wine. I tell you that. We got the best wine in the world. We actually are selling it now in Paris. We're selling it here. We're doing great. We're fifth in the nation now. We have 250 wineries in Virginia, 200 or about 100 craft breweries. And I got to tell you, for this bike race and to have all these people here, they're going to go all over. Because remember, you know, we're unique. We have Jamestown, which started our country when the Brits sent 3 ships over to America to start a stock trade company. Williamsburg, you've got Richmond, which is the whole center point of the Civil War, all of that history, Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home, but 100 craft breweries, 20 craft distilleries.
No wonder people are falling off their bikes.
Yeah. Well, you got to have fun. You only live once.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, come on. 28 miles of beaches. We've got it all. I don't know why anyone else would go to any other state, man. Oysters. We got it all.
Well, tell us about it. I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it? When you're overseeing such a grand project like this, and there's such a lot of stuff to show off, do you have to sort of push people into a certain direction? I mean, clearly there's going to be a lot of TV cameras there. As you said, there's a lot of visitors. All the hotels are booked out. You know, people are going to be wanting to, walk the beaches and cycle the paths and all the rest of it. Do you want to focus on certain things? You can't squeeze all of this, presumably all of the good things, into one thing. Have you and your people, your staff, and your PR people been kind of? Is it a tough balance to know which story to tell?
Well, the biggest issue we have, and the preparations, I say, and the mayor trying to get the city ready to have all, as I say, there's a paving truck on every street right now in Richmond. The one thing that's going to be interesting, the race finishes right in front of where I live in the executive mansion, the governor's mansion, which was built in 1813, the oldest governor's mansion in America. And the state office buildings are all around that. And I think for the 9 days, we haven't quite figured it out. They may be shut for 9 days. We've got to figure this out, how we're going to try and get people to work and so forth. There are tunnels underneath. Maybe we can have them use the tunnels. But the biggest challenge is just the sheer mechanics. We spent a lot of time putting the bike route together, but we wanted to do it in a way that showed the best parts of Richmond, obviously. And then they want to have some hills. And as I say, the end of this race is a very steep hill up Governor Street, right behind the governor's mansion that comes up. So I think it's pretty mean that they actually did this as the final part of the race to make them come up this big hill. But listen, these guys are professional cyclists. But as you know, great athletes. I went to the big kickoff event recently. We had a bunch of cyclists there. I just rode a bike the other day for a TV commercial for this. So, you know, we're all getting into the act to do it. It's going to be spectacular.
Terry, your president has just been in Garmisch, the guest of Angela Merkel, and the relations across the Atlantic have been put in focus over the past week. There's been some quizzing, actually, of the British and their intention to spend 2% of GDP on defence. You come to Europe at an interesting time. What does that relationship for you feel like when you're going to several countries here in Europe, you know, all these Europeans coming to your state? What do you feel of that transatlantic relationship at the moment?
Well, we're blessed in Virginia. In fact, Prince Charles was just in Virginia last month. I had the great opportunity of taking Prince Charles around Mount Vernon, George Washington's home. So for us in Virginia, we have such a special bond with the United Kingdom. But as I travel around the other nations, because we are the birthplace of America, we have sort of a special relevance. We're next to Washington, D.C. 8 presidents, we have the most presidents of the United States have come out of Virginia of any state in America. But America's relationship is so strong with Europe and the European nations. Obviously, if something happens over here with your economy, it greatly impacts what happens in the United States of America. So we really forged a great bond, and we're working together through the EU on issues that's going on in the Ukraine today and other issues with Iran. But we always have acted with one voice, and the relationship, no matter what party's been in power in America or the United Kingdom, that bond and friendship between our two nations is stronger than any political party because it's gone on for so long and such a heritage. As I say, we're named after Queen Elizabeth I, Virginia. So we have a very special bond with the United Kingdom.
And you've been strongly associated with the Clintons. Yep. As the election looms, what's your feelings about Hillary?
Well, listen, I've been friends with the Clintons now for over 30 years. I chaired President Clinton's campaign. I chaired Hillary Clinton's campaign. So I'll be very honest with you, in full disclosure, I'm very biased. But I know her so well. She's strong. She's tough. I'm excited as a father of 5 children with 3 young daughters. To have the first woman president of the United States of America. I mean, you obviously have done that here in the United Kingdom with your prime minister. So I think it's a huge opportunity for us. But she'll be a great president. She'll be focused, as I've done in Virginia, building the economy, diversifying the economy, but making sure when we talk about creating jobs, jobs that pay well, that have benefits, and that's got to be the focus. And so she's going to win. She's going to win the Democratic nomination. The Republicans have, I think we're going to have, I don't know, 20, 21 running. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I think the more people you have out on their side giving their message is, you know, something they ought to be doing. But at the end of the day, if you look at every poll, she's leading today. She's strong. She's tough. She knows the issues. And I think it will be a trendsetter to have a woman president of the United States. And I think that's a great message for nations around the globe. And it's a great, I can tell you this, it's a great message for my 3 daughters that you too, yes, can grow up to be president of the United States of America.
And presumably she could use a governor of Virginia that never steps out of his lycra.
Yeah. Well, and let me tell you this. We are going to win Virginia for her next November. I can promise you that. Take that one to the bank.
We'll take that one to the bank. And Just finally, Terry, I think you're off to Milan soon and you're off to, as Andrew was saying, to other countries in Europe. Is this very much fact-finding? Is this very much to kind of go, well, obviously the powerhouses of European cycling, France and Spain and Italy, is this to sort of pick up how they do things, how they run things, or is it just to make sure that your business card is in their hands so that they make sure they come on over to see the race?
Well, a little bit of all of it. Listen, I have a motto, sleep when you're dead. You know, listen, we're here. We want to meet as many people as we can. We want to outreach. We want them to all know about the bike race that's coming up because there's tremendous, obviously, economic activity associated with that. But, you know, I was here yesterday and landed and went up, as you know, up to Wales, where we announced, you know what is Admiral Insurance, Elephant Insurance in America, 1,200 new jobs they're bringing to Virginia. So I made that announcement yesterday. So it's a little jobs announcement. It's a little fishing expedition to talk to businesses. And most importantly, it's just to raise the awareness that this World Bike Race is going to be in Richmond, Virginia. And this is an opportunity that I do not want to let go by. I want people, and then when you guys go to bed tonight, I want one thing on your mind, Virginia.
We've got it, sir. But listen, thank you very much for your time.
Forget, Virginia's for lovers, so you take that for whatever it's worth.
I did. I saw that. I saw that on the website as well. That was the first one I clicked on.
I think Rob's coming to see you very soon.
Fine wine and fast bikes. Who can argue with that? Terry McAuliffe, Governor of Virginia, thank you very much for joining us. And those fantastic bike races, the UCI Road World Championships, take place in and around Richmond, Virginia from the 19th to the 27th of September. We'll be hopping from Virginia to Alabama next with Grammy-nominated soul band Alabama Shakes. Time for the music now. We're hearing from Alabama Shakes in just a few minutes, but first let's enjoy a track from their excellent recent album, Sound and Colour. Here it is, the title track. Alabama Shakes with Sound and Colour from an album of the same name. You're tuned into the Monocle Weekly. We'll be hearing from Alabama Shakes' Steve Johnson just after this.
The idea behind The Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites, we don't want to set up arguments, we just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Alabama
Alabama Shakes are the Athens, Alabama, surprisingly, based four-piece whose infectious, soulful songs have seen them grow from low-down and dirty boogie rockers into a Grammy-nominated headline act. Recent second album, Sound and Colour, is pushing their music into ever more intelligent and more sleek pop territory.
The band were in town in Toronto recently, and Monocle's Toronto bureau chief there, Thomas Lewis, couldn't miss the chance to shake his tail feathers with one of the best acts on the planet. So he caught up with the Alabama Shake Steve Johnson to learn how their southern roots music translates just north of the border.
Steve Johnson, I play drums with Alabama Shakes.
Bless my heart, bless my soul. Didn't think I'd make it to 22 years old.
And Alabama Shakes headlining Field Trip this year. Excited to be here?
Oh, without a doubt excited to be here. Love Canada, love Toronto.
What kind of sort of, I mean, Toronto is often described as kind of like a music city where kind of, it's still pretty much a free-for-all, I think it's fair to say, in terms of like people wanting to try stuff out, yeah. Plus the big names coming in. What kind of atmosphere do you find when you come into Canada and Toronto?
Very chill. This would only be probably my second or third trip to Toronto, but every time I'm here, we have good shows, the crowds are always like real pumped to see us, and overall just like friendly, like good vibes, good food.
Yes, I have interrupted your lunch, I should say, at this juncture, so I'll let you go back to that very shortly. It's been a big year for you all, I guess, new record out. How are you feeling about that and as the summer music sort of season takes up and you get to sort of showcase it, I guess, kind of live?
Well, I think we're all pretty excited that it's finally out. More excited to be touring it and like playing shows now instead of on the other end, the recording side of it. Once you finally get to tour it and play it out, it kind of like it feels like a good start to the process, I guess. And yeah, we're all excited to be playing it, all excited and proud of the album.
And the process of getting the album to in the studio and beyond, how was that? You know, when you're a couple of albums in, I guess, I wonder if the experience changes at all.
Oh, I'm sure it changes once you're a couple in. You have that experience and like know how studios work, know what your gear is capable of in the studio. That's kind of like a learning curve for, well, it was for me on this record because I hadn't had much studio time. None of us really had, but with the first one, like, we went in and just had the songs already done and just kind of, like, breezed through them recording. With this one, it was more like bits and pieces and demos and finding the right sounds and parts in the studio versus, like, having it arranged before you come in. Because then when you're in there, you kind of, like, you have the luxury of the control room right there and you can just easily pop in there and hear what you've done, see if it sounds good, if it makes sense. And if it doesn't, then you can just go right back into the tracking room and make adjustments, do what you want to do. Those were differences, but the process was, man, it was different, but it was good, you know, like just learning more about what you can do in the studio and what you're capable of and those kinds of things.
I guess you always have kind of, if goals is the wrong word, but kind of a set of things maybe you want to like create in sound when you start approaching a new record. What kind of sort of, you know, atmosphere, sound, you know, are you hoping to create if you do go into it kind of now?
Well, I know everybody's kind of got their own influences and maybe their own agenda when you're going into the studio. Like, say for instance, Brittany's got a demo she's wrote and she knows immediately like what vocal thing she's going for, what guitar thing she's going for. That still kind of leaves like bass and drums and keys in the air and like what kind of tones we're going to get. So somebody's got an idea when you get in there. And then when you get in there and everybody else starts hearing where it's going and like things are clicking in their head, you've got like little images or little blips, you know, going through your brain of like, oh, that could sound cool, that might work well. And then you just start trying stuff. And you've got everybody else in your team, you know, like, oh, well, I like that idea. What if you did this? those kinds of things start popping up, and then before you know it, you have a song, and that's about that.
I guess this is kind of a stupid question, actually, but is there kind of a track or kind of a moment in a track that you're kind of, when you listen back to it kind of now, or when you play it kind of live, that you still get a bit of a tingle down your spine?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's not even like, I don't know, I don't even think it would be something that somebody was particularly proud of, but it is a moment that just cracks me up every time. And there's a little bass run that Zach does on the track Shoegaze. It's like funky, it's kind of out of place. I mean, to any other listener, they'd be like, oh yeah, that's just part of the song. But he didn't mean to do it in the studio. It was a little bit of a flub for him, or an accident. But we were tracking live, and we had the mics turned up, and it would have been in anybody else's mic as well, so we couldn't, it was there, it was just in the track, couldn't take it away. And he hates it, but I love it so much. Everybody else was just like, dude, that's cool, that totally works. He's like, stupid, I don't like it, man, I wish I could redo it. And I'm like, no, that song is done. So we were playing it yesterday live, and he actually does it, playing it live sometimes, just for like, it's not something he would normally do, he just does it to crack me up, I think. But he did it, and I turned and looked at him and just started laughing. Funny.
Nice. Getting a kick out of a mistake,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, mistakes. They're natural, they're fun, they make you laugh, you just blow it off and keep on playing.
And I guess there's a bit of magic to that as well, especially in a sort of live context, I guess.
Yeah, totally. If you mess up and it still sounds good and doesn't mess the track up, man, hats off to you and hats off to Zach.
So just finally then, you've got a very busy summer ahead, kind of doing the festival circuit. Is there something you're particularly excited about? And I suppose in the context of the new record, are you... You know, what kind of chapter in the Alabama Shake story is that for you?
Well, first of all, I am like excited to be playing the songs and playing them. It's challenging, it's trying at times, because the songs are, some of them step in a different direction, you know, like doing the festival thing. We learned before with Boys and Girls that like at a festival, nobody really like wants to be lullabied or like put to sleep, really, especially if you're like on main stage or closing a bill or something. They want to rock. They want to get amped up and everything. So it's a little challenging with some of the new material, because the new material's a little spacey and like really chill in some spots. They're not like rock and roll, like just slam them out songs. Some of them are, but it's been like trying to make a balance between like the old material and new material, and like, you know, getting them pumped, but then like bringing them back down for a minute and getting them pumped up again. It's weird, because you have to have that energy, you've got to be in that headspace, and then you've got to get it to come across to, you know, big group of people. So I think that's what we all like about it, is that it is challenging, it's different, you know, we're not just playing Boys and Girls still, you know, to the same people, because, you know, people, they'll want to hear something new, and that's what we're trying to do, is make the new stuff fit and be exciting, and like, you know, maybe they haven't heard the new album yet, and all that stuff. It all comes into play, comes into mind when you're playing festivals.
Awesome. Well, have a fantastic summer, and can't wait for the set later.
Gracias. I am pumped for the summer. Just to clarify.
Now you can get back to your lunch.
Yeah, this is important right here.
You got to hold on. You got to hold on. You got to hold on.
And that was Monocle's Thomas Lewis speaking to Alabama Shakes' Steve Johnson. Do you think we said Alabama Shakes enough times, Rob?
I know. Well, it's obviously for all those listeners playing the Alabama Shakes drinking game. once again, you can take a nip of whatever rye whiskey, perhaps, that you enjoy. And we're still sober, though, aren't we?
Yeah.
In the studio. We never let work and play interfere. We haven't had a gin tasting in a while.
No, you haven't had the Alabama Shakes for ages.
Hey! That's what we like. London will do. And what do we got coming up next? We've got Richard Dobbs, who's written No Ordinary Disruption.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulet and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulet or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
As director of the McKinsey Global Institute, one of the world's largest business consultancies, Richard Dobbs is well placed to spot the points where economic and global cultural forces meet. But recently, Richard and his peers, James Manyika and Jonathan Wurzel, have come to question traditional business patterns, and the result is No Ordinary Disruption, the four global forces breaking all the trends. A new book that highlights a need for us to reset our economic intuition.
The book cites factors such as acceleration of technological development, the rise of emerging markets, an aging global population, and increased trade opportunities as game changers that the world should start paying attention to. Richard is here now to tell us a little bit more. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. First of all, when you've put out an interesting list of facts surrounding the book, and they all look slightly depressing and worrying about our jobs are going to vanish, we won't be needed, there's going to be this huge aging population decline in the people who are out there to generate wealth. But at the end of the book, you say, actually, the whole point is be positive. Explain to us how, when there's this kind of tide of really worrying figures coming in this way, we should still feel positive about the world.
I think the message is that we are facing these four large disruptions, which are larger than anything we've ever seen, and we're having all four of them hitting us at the same time. As a result, the world is going to be very different. What we have to do is we have to go through these disruptions, and we have to be ready for the different world. Now, you can say that, as you said, there are some negative things about the world we're going into. We're going to be in a world where jobs are going to disappear more rapidly. Middle-class jobs are going to be hit as well, in the same way as working-class jobs have been hit by automation over the last 20, 30 years. The negative things is also governments are going to have deficits that they're going to have to deal with, social problems. But we've also some positive things. We're going to be able to have tailored drugs that be able to deal with cancer in your body. We're going to take a global middle class of a billion people in 1990 to 4 billion. So if you're selling any product, you're basically going to have four times the market you could potentially deal with. And we're going to be able to have a world where we've already taken a billion people out of poverty and we're going to take more. We're going to have a world where we're going to be able to sit at home and access everything that's ever been written and be able to read it. So, you know, part of it is going to be negative. Part of it is going to be positive. We think the winners are going to be the ones who actually spot the opportunities and say, look, I may have to retrain. I'm going to have to stop being somebody that used to make cars and I'm going to become a tour guide for Chinese tourists as they visit the UK. You know, and the people that are successful are the optimists who see the opportunity and retrain.
One of the things that comes out of your book is something that's been cited as the age of urbanisation, capital A, capital U. And this is about how cities are going to become even more powerful than they are today. This has been something that, in fact, at Monocle magazine, we talk about quite a lot, the power of the city. What happens socially to that when cities almost want to be their own states? And what happens to nations in the future, do you think?
Well, I think that for a bunch of the way that politics needs to work, the mayor becomes a very important job. Now, if you actually look in a bunch of Asian countries like China, you cannot be the head of China as a country unless you've run a city. And it's actually a great role of pulling stuff together, and you have to run stuff. So I think that a lot of delivery is better done at the city level. Now, not everything. You don't have a currency at the city level. So I think that as we look going forward, though, a lot of the decision making can actually be better done at the city level. And maybe it's about a cluster of cities, some of the things like George Osborne's looking at here, where you put a group of cities together and you create a cluster, because that is actually where delivery happens. And similarly, we think that companies and individuals, as they allocate resources, it might be better to do it at a city level than at a country level. Now, it makes more sense to say, well, I'm going to be worrying about Jakarta rather than if I was saying I'm going to be doing BRICS, I would be running off looking at China.
And a lot of and you know, China is very much the elephant in the room in all of these things as well, because we're told that cities that we could hardly place on a map, or you could even name, let alone place on a map, are going to be the sort of economic powerhouses and the manufacturing powerhouses in the next 25 years. Did the Chinese write books like we write about business?
The Chinese.
I mean, I wonder if in another universe, this exact same thing is happening in a Chinese studio.
I think the Chinese are, first of all, they spend a lot of time reading other stuff. Yeah. I went to China, met some senior policymakers there, and they had read a report that I'd written, had been translated into Chinese for them to read. So first of all, they spend a lot of time studying it. Mm. They are very thoughtful. They also have, you know, there's some downsides to their political system, but their political system does take a longer term horizon. The problem, I think, is that many of us in the West have a political system where it's all about what you've done in the last government and what you're going to promise me for the next government. The Chinese government do spend time saying, look, what's it going to take for us to deal with the aging over the next 30, 40 years and put the political pressures under that? And I think there's sort of some thoughtfulness there going on about long-term views in terms of the world.
But one of the things that I wanted to ask you is just looking back over history. So another one of these amazing figures is 140 million knowledge workers' jobs could be replaced by computers and 75 million jobs by robots. So that, again, a slightly terrifying figure. But when you look back, I guess, you know, in the 60s when computers came, people were terrified that all the jobs would disappear. And the economy somehow changes and refixes itself and still absorbs people. So although those jobs will go, what do you think will happen to the people whose jobs are taken away by those?
Well, I think the humans have proved to be massively adaptive. Think about the monks that used to write the Bibles. And those jobs got replaced by the printing press. So the monks that used to handwrite
Bibles, they got into beer making.
Yeah, well, beer making or selling pardons or whatever. I mean, you know, they redeployed. Think about, you know, what the first office you ever visited. Think about the size of the typing pool, or, you know, if you weren't visiting an office, think about Mad Men. You know, the size of the typing pool in those businesses. Those have largely disappeared. You don't get typing pools like that. So we have been very successful at redeploying it. And I think redeploying people. The numbers are quite frightening in terms of the scale redeploying happening. But, you know, as we move towards 4 billion middle-class consumers around the world, they're going to want to have different activities. And there are still a lot of things that you still need people for, that we've just got to redeploy that. And I think that part of the challenge is going to be how we reskill people, so that the person who was working as a switchboard operator has been reskilled, so they're doing something else. The person who was working in the typing pool has successfully been redeployed. What are we going to do to the people that are going to be next jobs are going to disappear, and how are we going to reskill them so they can move into other stuff? Because I think that, you know, particularly as our population starts shrinking, or working population shrinking, it's actually quite good that some of these jobs are going to disappear.
But I was just going to jump in there. What's intriguing for Monocle is one of the things that we chart a lot is that there has been, in the face of maybe this, that there is a kind of return for many people, you know, not the numbers you see employed by huge corporations, but in smaller businesses, you know, a return to making stuff, even in Europe, manufacturing clothing. We just were in Portugal doing a story, and the reshoring of manufacturing to Portugal, where people are, you know, are with their hands making shirts and jumpers every day. Do you feel that there is a concurrent thing that does run with this? You know, a kind of a renewed interest in, you know, the number of people who you see leaving their jobs, even in the city, they go off and what do? They open a baker's, or they open a brewery, or they're oddly these two things run parallel with each other.
I think completely. And the great news about technology is it's going to allow some of these smaller businesses to compete. If you ran a regional clothes shop 20 years ago, it was really difficult for you to sell clothes around the world. Now you can be on eBay, or you can be on a cloud-based system, you can be on Alibaba, and you can actually sell those clothes around the world. So you can compete with the large corporation in a way that it wasn't possible before. So I think the good news is technology is going to allow a number of these different niche businesses to be able to be established. And I think that people are going to like that and they're going to pay for that. If we have automation in a bunch of things, we're going to value the service that you get from a good waiter or a good barman in terms of going to a bar. So there'll be aspects that we'll go and we'll value. And I think that the great thing is that technology is going to allow some of those people to be able to compete.
Because that's a good example. You could imagine going to a bar where you pressed a button and the machine delivered a beer in front of you. That could be a robot-replaced job. But in fact, it doesn't kind of happen, does it? Because in fact, although we know there is a capability for these jobs to be replaced, we still hanker after the human, the tactile, the real. Yeah. And that delays maybe some of these sweeping of away of jobs.
Well, or some of the jobs that are swept away are going to be replaced by other types of stuff. People are going to suddenly go from, instead of sweeping up in their garden, getting someone else to do it. So there'll be other activities that we'll be able to afford to do. Because the other thing about the technology that comes in to replace some of those jobs is it makes those activities cheaper.
Yeah.
If your airline allows you to be able to do a internet check-in, it costs the airline less to run the airline than if you have to have check-in staff. That means that we can all afford to fly places that we couldn't afford to fly. We go the weekends, and therefore we'll have a waiter giving us a beer when we're sitting on a beach somewhere around the world, whatever, rather than us being at home. So I think there are jobs that are going to be created as a result of some of this stuff. And I think the key question is, do we have enough agility in terms of the population? Do we have enough people who are able to go from one job to another and be able to provide the new level of service that are exciting? But I think the personal touch we're still going to want to value and pay for.
And we think in Europe that we're quite good at the personal touch, don't we? Certainly in Western Europe. And I fear it's a bit of an existential question I've got for you, Richard, actually, is the idea that, do you see a future where Europe will simply be the leisure playground of the rest of the world's wealthy countries, that we are only good at that we don't make stuff? Because it's one of those strange things. In the 50s, we all thought that robots were going to clean our houses and that we would live in leisure. And now we kind of hanker after, as Andrew was saying, maybe even fitting cars together with our own hands, or that someone in our family would do that for a living, that someone in our family would be a tailor, would stitch stuff together. Do you think that we, existentially, we will miss that if all we're doing is pouring beers for wealthy Chinese businesses?
Well, I think that there is a challenge of making sure that we get the innovation, that Europe pushes innovation as well. I think there is the sort of the scenario where we become the sort of the Disney World for the Chinese tourists, that there's the sort of the royal land, this is England, and then you have sort of beach land, etc., that you could end up with a sort of scenario like that. But I think that part of it is to make sure that we innovate. And there is a negative scenario that leading innovation moves to Silicon Valley, that Europe ends up as a tourist activity or whatever. But I think we've also got some great pieces of innovation. Look at what goes on in London. Look at the innovation happening in London. Look at the fact that people want to come and live here. I think that we have a good opportunity to do that. So there is this sort of potential crisis. Are we going to be repositioning that? But I think that the evidence suggests that we're able to do that.
But while you see the strength, say, of Silicon Valley or London as a commercial market, the book posits the idea that really it'll be a much more multipolar world going forward, that there'll be all sorts of areas of opportunity, that Central Asia will become much more important. And is that your feeling, that that there will be all of these pockets of opportunity? Because it's what's interesting, again, as you talk about these places, in the end, there's quality of life that comes in, and do we really want to live in that city? So there's amazing, on paper, wonderful cities in China doing great things with their economy. But do you want to live there if you have an opportunity to live in San Francisco or London or Nanjing? Then often that people would choose somewhere where they had more political liberty, or they had a greater quality of life.
Yeah, but I think the quality of life will far follow. I mean, I take London in the 50s with the smog. There were a lot of people saying, well, who would want to live in London with all that smog? We addressed it. We had quality of life. I mean, the 70s, London, you couldn't go out and have a decent meal. you know, we fix that. So I think that quality of life will happen in some of those cities. I think the question is, you know, how will that pace will happen? You know, you look at cities like Seoul that used to be, you know, quite grim, have actually become quite a fun place. I lived there for 6 years and it was actually quite a happening city and the quality of life was there. So I think we can get quality of life in some of those cities in terms of how we make them fun places to
live.
And
where do you pinpoint then as a place to look for opportunity going forward? If you had a dollar to invest, well, I'm sure you do have $1, but where would you look to China or to?
I think the challenge on China is that if you look at Chinese businesses in China is that while they've got great growth, the returns are quite tough. You know, a lot of the businesses do very badly on returns on capital. What I would do is I would be looking at how you benefit from China being outside China. So Indonesian resorts where the Chinese are going to go on holiday. You know, luxury products. I think the luxury products, while they've been run up, they've been only run up by us now having 2 billion consumer class. The Chinese are going to want to buy luxury exactly the same way as the Japanese and the Koreans. You know, when I lived in Korea, I used to get the Monocle magazine. That was provided by my credit card company in Korea as, you know, the type of thing that, you know, you should be reading as a well-informed Korean executive. And, you know, the Chinese are going to have the same attitude to luxury and the types of products you guys write about all the time, you know, is going to be what the Chinese are going to do. So I think I would play the luxury game and the tourism game and look about the fact that we're going to have a wealthy class coming up in these countries and work out how to play it.
The argument will go on and on. The answers to it, perhaps, are in the book. No Ordinary Disruption, The Four Global Forces Breaking All the Trends, the co-author of which was Richard Dobbs. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Richard.
And there we have it, Andrew. That was it for edition 310 of the Monocle Weekly. Sort of a nice round number. I quite enjoyed that show, but due to the pressures of time, because we allowed a lot of time with our friend and colleague, Tom Edwards, we only have time to high-five each other.
Wish you good luck in Thailand next week.
Wish me good luck in Thailand.
Me? I'm off to Italy.
Oh, yeah. You're going to have a nice time.
Yeah?
It's going to be
work. I'm stressing work.
Mine's going to be a lot of work as well. Motorbike.
Motorbike. Yes. Okay.
It's a family show.
Well, today's show was produced by Mr. Thomas Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Claire Urban.
And the Monocle Weekly will be back again at the same time next week, but with Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards in the presenters' chairs. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.